And now, the Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
They have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind, so they have an extra one. And that's how we get the podcast. The podcast. The podcast. Woo! The Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
Yeah, boy.
Wow, that's a kind of a jam right there, right, man?
What AI did y'all make that on?
AI. Yeah. That was ChatGPT-4.
I like it. That's awesome.
Yeah, we every week we have some AI-generated random thing. We never know what it's going to be. Sometimes it'll be Vikings chanting. Some days it's the same words, the same lyrics.
Bubba was going to do, because we're going to talk about the Opry and stuff, and we'll get into it in a second, but he was like, should I do like a, I was like, man, because I would like, I enjoy the
randomness.
The randomness of it. And from the very beginning, we're like, hey, the first one is going to be random, then the last one going out is the same one.
Except for my thought process is somebody, you know, if you're signing on to it and you hear it and you go, oh, that's not what I was looking for, and you just skip. It's a different.
You always know when you hear that. Yes. You always know that the little robot's coming on.
I got you.
All right.
The voice you hear there is Bubba. The other one is Mark Wills. And also Craig Shelburne is here. Hey, Craig. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nice to meet you.
And also going to throw in Greg Hill as well, because he's on a microphone over in that back corner that
we
probably
sure
can't
we
be
do
seen.
That?
Golly, man, I know. Life. Greg will tell us what to do, how to do it.
Greg is tank.
He's the perfect manager for that.
No one has tanked more careers than that guy.
With friends like you.
First of all, Greg, what you do is you pull the microphone down in front of your mouth.
Do you want to? You don't have to.
I'm here. I'm just here to help.
Craig,
I say we spend the next 45 minutes just busting on Greg.
Oh, it's the best. I love him so
nice
much.
Nice to know you.
The real star here, though, is Craig, because he has delivered an unbelievable book. It's called 100 Years of Grand Ole Opry. Interesting this. You don't put the Grand Ole Opry. Just put 100 Years of Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah.
On purpose?
Yep.
And why?
I asked about that, actually, because the show is just the three words. People casually refer to it as the Grand Ole Opry, but the way the show is actually titled is Grand Ole Opry.
Really?
Yeah.
So this book is, I mean, you can't drop it from a second story. You'll kill someone. It is so heavy and well done, full of pictures, and the here you go, Bubba, and full of the stories.
It's the first time I've gotten to hold it.
Behind the Opry. It's
I like
so
the
good.
Texture.
Yeah.
So what?
It's
so
a coffee table book, man. This is one you want to have out proudly.
Yeah.
Like when people come over, they're going to be like sipping their whatever they're sipping and looking through.
What's a couple of things that you like you learned from the research of the book that you were like, oh wow, I didn't know that.
There was a lot of decisions in the 40s and 50s that really shaped the show that we're still seeing today. That was pretty interesting to me. There's a period of time when this is probably in the 30s or 40s. I don't remember the exact year, but the show was at what is now the Belcourt Theater. And they hired the librarian at WSM to kind of help.
Wait a second. There's a radio station that had a librarian? Is that what you said?
A music librarian. So
for
the charts, for the music charts.
Oh, gotcha.
But artists were coming and going and coming and going so many times, and they couldn't keep track of them. So he's like, let's just do segments. You're expected here from 7 to 7:30. You're expected here from 7:30 to 8. And that's how the segment started. And then WSM, being an insurance company, always looking at the bottom line, they said, let's have sponsors for these segments.
Uh-huh.
And that's still there, too. Like, if you come to the Opry now, those segments are still there, brought to you by various sponsors, and they're just as much fun as usually. It's a lot of fun to hear them.
Yeah, I love the whole radio-ness of it, because it is still that old-fashioned radio show. Even though it's modern, especially now they have the new microphone and the new set and everything, it's very modern. But at the same time, the presentation is still a throwback, like the way it was done back in the day.
There's nothing, to me, man, there's nothing better. You get in this time of year, spring and summer, I will sit outside of the fire pit of the house and listen to SMAM. Just that. And I want that. I want the AM. I kind of want that.
The crackle.
The staticky-ness of it. And we'll just sit out there and just listen to whatever, you know, whoever it's going to be on that night. Maybe it's Mark.
If it's Mark.
Exactly.
It's kind of like that.
We've updated our microphone since then.
You were there last night.
I was. Yeah, I did the Opera Country Classic show last night.
And that's kind of a new thing, isn't it?
Well, I think Larry and the Gatlins, I think they've been hosting that for probably 15, maybe 20 years.
That's not
they
new
do
thing
it kind of
mind.
A spring summer. It's a Thursday night show.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about that show is that if you're so last night I was the spotlight artist, which meant that I could sing some of my songs. But typically when you do that show, we have a rule that it's 25 years or older. And so, you know, of songs that you sing. So like basically when I started, you know, when we started doing it 20 years ago, you were having to sing songs from the early 80s.
Or something like that.
And so, you know, I would sing, like last night I sang Jack Green, and I sang some Whitley. And, you know,
you ever get into, and there's some of these guys and songs that you don't know, and you kind of feel like, should I know that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there are artists that just have an amazing memory for that kind of stuff. And back when I was singing, you know, in the bars and in clubs and stuff like that, my repertoire was bigger, you know, because you had to sing different stuff all the time. You know, for the last 29 years, yeah, I've been singing Mark Wills songs. So, right, you know, so it's narrowed. But yeah, man, I look forward to those nights. You know, they'll sometimes have a theme for the evening. And, you know, and we'll come in and I'll sing some George Strait, or I'll sing some Ronnie Millsap, or I'll sing, you know, Alabama or whatever, you know, because I love music I grew up listening to and still love performing to this very day.
Yeah. Craig, did you grow up going to the Opry?
No, I grew up in rural Nebraska, but I started watching the Opry in the 90s with my grandparents. I spent a lot of weekends with them, and they had TNN on basically from the time
TNN.
The time it was over.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's basically how I got my country music education on Saturday nights, because at the time it would be like a half-hour segment,
mm-hmm,
and they would have someone who's very contemporary, but the host would be someone who was a legacy artist. And so the legacy artist would sing, somebody new would sing, and then there'd be another person that I wasn't familiar with. But as you watch it every week, you start to learn the cast, and then you get interested. Well, where did they come from? Who's Wilma Lee Cooper? She seems like a pretty cool person, you know? And
yeah,
and their personalities back then really shine through. You probably believe that too,
because like
in the 90s, you could get the personality of the artist on TNN. TNN was a force back then.
It was, and I miss it to this day.
Me too.
I truly miss. You know, we have TikTok, and we have that kind of stuff. But man, there was something about, you know, being able to sign, you know, flip on your television and see what Porter Wagner was, mm-hmm, wearing tonight, or what Little Jimmy Dickens was wearing. And that's some of the first times that you would see, you know, Vince Gill.
Yeah.
You would see Steve Warner. You would see
it really
Garth
humanizes.
Brooks,
it humanizes them.
Absolutely.
And then you become uber fans.
Yeah. It messed up a lot of people for me, though. I remember seeing people going, is that what they look like?
Really?
Well, yeah. You're like, yeah, that's not what I expected. Yeah. And no one specifically comes to mind. Actually, Ricky Skaggs, I think, was – I didn't expect him to look the way he looked.
Yeah.
Like, well, now he looks like
Moses.
I was going to say Benjamin Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin, yeah, with the long hair. Yeah.
Yeah.
I heard somebody say Moses not too long ago, and I was like, well, you know.
That's not terrible.
Craig, is there any – what's a good Opry drama history?
Oh, some drama?
Was there ever any kind of like a
– Oh, yeah. There was a lot of drama, and some of it was in the 90s, but there was also some in the 50s. Actually, one of the earliest examples was the guy that founded the Opry basically was George D. Hay, and he was under a lot of stress, had a nervous breakdown, and took a leave of absence. So the general manager kind of took that as his opportunity. His name was Harry Stone.
You mean his opportunity?
His opportunity to think, let's bring in some vocal groups. Let's try something different.
It's actually
and
really
then the
good.
Crowds respond. Listeners like that.
Oh.
But then the old-timers didn't like that because the Opry needs to be this way.
Yeah.
Right.
And so there's been that conversation between what the Opry should be and what the Opry actually is,
you know,
forever.
But that's a society thing.
Yep.
I mean, the old saying is, what does everybody hate? The way they are, the way things are. But what do they hate more? Change.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, there's always that. We have to hang on to it because that's the way it's always been done.
Yeah.
Hank Williams Sr. Gets into the Opry and then gets fired?
Yeah. It didn't work. He was super, super popular, and his personal demons kept him from being reliable. And the Opry is every Saturday night. They have it, you know, it's every every weekend. Yeah. It's the world's longest running radio show. And if they're counting on their star attraction to be there and he doesn't come, you get a warning if he does it again. A sterner warning and basically one last chance. And he just,
it was just from
he
drinking,
couldn't pull it together.
Just
yeah.
from drinking.
And,
well, yeah. we were talking about it off the air, but, you know, yep. you have to remember that, you know, in the 40s, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, there was no social media. There was no TNN. There was, you know, there was no really television.
Right.
This was the way people got their entertainment. So you would put your cast together for a Saturday night show, and you would have Ernest Tubb, and you would have Hank Williams Sr., and you would have, you know, the big stars of the day, Roy Acuff. You would have all them, and they would be on your show, and then they would do the Saturday night show, and then they would have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday to travel and make their living, but they all had to reconverge on the Ryman or the Belcourt mm-hmm. or Franklin Theater or wherever it was being held at the time.
Do they have the Franklin Theater?
Was it in
a
Franklin?
War Memorial Auditorium?
That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry, you're right. Mm-hmm. So they were, you know, and wherever it was being held at that moment, they would have to converge back onto that.
Which is so different because nowadays everybody does their big touring on weekends.
Right.
And then so, like, that's why Tuesday Night Opry has been an amazing thing because you never know who you're going to see on Tuesdays even now. You're right. Like, what? They're there? Are you kidding me?
With this book, we did most of our Opry's, including the interview we did with Mark. We did most of the interviews backstage on the night that the artist performed. And we were out there a lot of Tuesdays and Wednesdays.
How long did it take to do this book?
About 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was important to me to figure out what the story was before. I mean, figure out the story as I was working on it. I didn't approach it in a way that I knew what I felt like I knew what the story was. And I'm going to find evidence to support it. I went in pretty blank slate. I knew a little bit about the Opry. And I loved it for, you know, my whole life, basically. But I wanted to find out what the story actually was rather than just try to imprint my love of the Opry onto it. So it's it moves fast. If you read it, it moves pretty fast.
It's a really
100 years history.
Who when you're doing the interviews, is anyone that you were like, they were terrible?
No. I don't think so.
Are you looking at me? Are you looking at me?
Actually, you know, it's cool. I popped the book open right here to this page, and look at this little dude.
Yeah, man.
What?
It's going back to... And those photos are going back to the beginning.
Yeah. Woo.
It's Mark Wills, like, way back when.
Yeah, they opened the entire photo archive of the Opry to us for this book. So there's pictures that have never been seen.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was looking at the one when Chris Young got inducted, and he's bear-hugging Vince Gill.
Yeah.
He's got him, like, it looks like he's about to flip him over. Like,
like a wrestling move.
Yeah. Like he's about to do a souffle, I think.
Souffle.
Something like that. Yeah, whatever. Where do people get the book at?
It's several places. It's a nationally distributed book. So this version here is at Target.
This thing is substantial.
Yep. Yeah. If you go to Target, there's one with the black cover. The Opry gift shop and other places have the blue cover.
What is that noise?
Barnes & Noble has
it.
Him slamming
the book.
He's closing this gigantic book. I'm telling you, this thing is huge.
Yeah. Yes. It's anywhere you buy books, really.
Yeah. There's a real, I think people, they see Grand Ole Opry, and you know they have stories of their own, or maybe they go. But being backstage is a completely different show, and you get to have the interactions with artists. And Mark, as an artist, I mean, isn't you kind of get there as almost like a, it's almost kind of a like a guy a man cave almost, for artists.
Well, didn't an artist cave. You were telling us one time that you go even when you're not performing just to go and be backstage to see all this go down.
Well, I think first and foremost, you know, I'm an Opry member and I've been doing this for 30 years. I'm still a fan.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, you know, and I don't live here in town. So, you know, if I'm in Nashville, 3.5-4 hours away from home, would I rather sit in a hotel room and, you know, watch Netflix? Or would I rather go over and catch an Opry show and see your friends?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's many nights where, you know, I'll come in on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, have something going on Thursday, playing the Opry on Friday. And if I'm in town, I'll absolutely go over and you know, hang backstage. And some of the rituals that go on backstage, like, you know, I don't know if it's in the book or not, but dressing room number one, Mr. Acuff's dressing room. So When Mr. Acuff was alive, there was an open door policy, and that door was never closed. It's a dressing room, but the door never closes.
What about whenever somebody was getting dressed?
That's the door never closed.
Oh, wow.
So you know, if you had to get dressed, you could go somewhere else. But dressing room number one, Mr. Acuff would sit in the room. And there's many, you know, there's many different theories as to why the door never closed. But I like to think, I would like to think in my mind that you know, the way it was, in you know, the way it was told to me was that he always wanted to see who was heading to the stage. He always wanted to have the opportunity to say hello, especially if it was your first time on the Opry, or to say, you know, hey, you know, last time when you were here, you did a great job. And so, you know, Vince is typically in dressing room. He'll be there tonight, you know, when he's there. If Vince is not there, I'm usually in dressing room number one. So we try to continue on that tradition. You know?
So where do you get dressed?
Well, first of all, I typically show up at the Opry with my pants on.
Okay.
So,
well,
you know,
you never know.
So,
that is a pro tip right there.
Dressing room in name only.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's okay. It's
like
room.
A locker room then at that point.
Yes. And it's the only dressing room in the dressing rooms that have its own bathroom.
Yeah.
So like if you need to go in and step into like where the toilet shower area is, you can go in there and close the door and change there. But yeah, so it's just those little things like that.
Wouldn't
that,
it be cool if like
special.
They permanently mounted the door to where it could never close?
Well, you know, I don't even know why there's a door on it. That's what I've always wondered. If it's an open door policy and you're in dressing room number one, why is there a door?
Is it bad luck if somebody, like, let's say somebody's new and they're like
been
in
artists.
Janitorial or, oh, really?
There have been artists that close the door. And especially since I have.
What happens?
Well, especially since I've become a member, I will tell them.
Yeah.
I will knock on the door and go, hey, just FYI, this door doesn't close during the show. And they're like, really? And I'm like,
yeah.
It doesn't close during the show.
Yeah.
And you can tell them, hey, if you want to go to a different dressing room, go to a different. If you want to close your door,
do they think you're being like?
I don't care what they think.
Territorial.
I don't care. There are certain things that you know. There are certain traditions that I feel you know should be honored.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's kind of one of them.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in dressing, if you want to go to the Opry and close the door, that's fine. But go to dressing room number two, or go to dressing room number three. Because one has that mystique of always having an open door policy, and it's the one closest to the stage.
Craig, was there anything in the book about in your research about paranormal activity at the Opry?
Yeah, a couple things that didn't make it in there, but you know, Trisha has talked about feeling the ghost at the Opry. There's a stage manager named Tim Thompson who worked at the Ryman before he worked at the Opry House. He's got some stories too. There's definitely, in my opinion, there's definitely ghosts in there.
I have one I can tell you.
Yeah.
I have two, actually. So when I became an Opry member, I was given my locker. And my locker was Jean Shepherd's before she passed away. And Jean had been there for years. So that was always her locker. And when they gave me my locker and I went and programmed my code into the locker for the first year that I was there, it never worked. And I thought, you know, I'm not much for paranormal stuff, but I thought, you know, I'm going to do something. I'm going to try something I heard. So I found Miss Jean's first promotional picture, and I put it up in my locker. And every time I open my locker door, I say hello to her. And ever since then, my locker has worked every time.
Wow.
You can believe it if you want to.
Well, I believe it.
But I'm telling you.
I've seen some whack stuff, and I believe.
Well, I have one other that I can tell you that was a crazy thing that happened to us. So, you know, we're sitting backstage. We're doing a tribute show. The Malpas brothers are on the show that night, and Lori Morgan had sent Keith Whitley's Martin to be played on the Opry that night. So we sit in the dressing room. We're playing old Keith Whitley songs, you know, having a great time. On Keith's guitar. Go out and take my jacket off that I'd worn on stage. Go to put it in my locker. Close my locker door. And as I close my locker door, the locker next to me pops open. and there's a guitar in the locker. Okay. Don't think anything about it. Walk up to Mr. Jim's desk, say, "Hey, locker next to mine is open. Just wanted to, you know, let you know so we could lock it up, whoever's locker it is." We walk back, take the magic key, stick it in the door, and it's Lori Morgan's locker.
Oh, wow.
So we had been sitting there playing Whitley songs in the Opry all night on Keith's guitar. And when I went to close my locker, the locker that popped open was Lori's.
Have you ever seen that before?
No.
Or since?
No.
Yeah, they don't just pop open.
Well, no, if you're saying there's a code. It's a lock.
So I'm
saying
code.
That's a pretty intricate lock. I wouldn't imagine it could just
unlock and open.
Just, yeah, that's crazy.
Just open. And when if you ever talk to, like, there's multiple artists that have experienced things in the Opry House.
Well, you know, at the Ryman they have ghost tours.
Yeah,
going underneath the stage. How much of the book do you cover, like, on the Opry? I mean, the Ryman.
The Ryman, yeah. So the Opry moved into the Ryman in 1943 and stayed until 1974. So it's a pretty good chunk of time that we spend in the Ryman in the manuscript.
And then a lot of people don't understand why it moves back. Why does it move back and forth from the Ryman to where it is now?
Well, it moved out to its current home because the company that owned the Opry had the theme park out there, and one of the executives had knew about Astro World and had noticed that, like, a theme park surrounded Astroworld, and they thought, well, that would probably work in Nashville because you've got, like, Disney, you've got Cinderella's Castle and Disneyland surrounded by a theme park. So they thought if the Opry is in the middle of a theme park, we're always going to have traffic. So that's really why it moved in the first place.
Oh, okay.
Because the theme park and the Opry really support it. And the hotel, too, of course.
Right.
The trifecta.
And also at Opryland, they were doing, like, musical numbers. Like, it was like, it's like kind of like Dollywood now, where they have, like, all the, you know, they sing and dance feature and stuff.
Yeah, that's where Diamond Rio came from. It's where a lot of acts got their start in the 80s, you know, 80s and 90s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Before it closed down, was a lot of the people that, you know, you think of as musicians now, they got their start at Opryland.
Who was it that worked at Opryland? We had talked to them about, they were doing singing telegrams too. And it was somebody, they worked at Opryland.
Oh, yeah.
And
was it Alan?
I don't remember.
Alan worked in the mailroom at TNN, but.
Alan Jackson.
Yeah.
Hey, Al.
Sorry.
No, I love that. Clip of Alan Jackson on it's some old TNN thing, and they're like, "Hey, we got this guy out of the audience."
Yeah,
and
with his hat all bent up there. It was great.
And they called him Al.
It was not Stephen Curtis Chapman. You can talk. There is a microphone in front of you. Craig's writing me notes. Thank you,
Craig. Craig, be better. What's your favorite Opry memory, Greg?
Mark Wills.
Oh, stop it.
Jeez, what a homer.
No, I honestly can remember years ago going in and seeing Mr. Acuff and meeting Bill Monroe and those things right when I came to town, which is still, you think about those legends back there and how welcoming they were.
Yeah, the legacy of the Opry. Yeah.
Well, and you've also been there, I mean, because you've managed countless acts. You've been there on people's first nights. What is that like? And Mark, maybe you can also talk about that too. What is going through your mind and their minds whenever they're going up for their very first time to step into the circle?
For me, I don't remember it.
At all?
It was, okay, so I credit the Opry now with the film crew and all of the documentation that you have when you make your Opry debut for so many of these artists. Because for me, the night that I came in, you know, we drove in. I had been to the Opry House because I had done Crook and Chase. I had done Primetime Country, but I had never played the Opry. And so, you know, you show up there, and at the time, Bob Whitaker, who was the GM, he meets me at the door, and he says, you know, "Hey, Mark, you know, welcome to the Grand Ole Opry. You know, I'm Bob. You know, if there's anything that you need, you're going to be in this dressing room." And literally, I walked in. I set my guitar down. I went and did the Opry pre-show, which was on TNN at the time. I talked to Jeannie Seely that night on camera. We had a great little interview. And then, you know, and then basically they go, "Okay, you got 30 seconds to get to the stage." And I ran to the stage. They put my guitar on me. I sang Jacob's Ladder. and it was over. And I remember none of the performance. Because it was just boom, boom. It was just thing, one thing after another, boom, boom, boom. So much.
It was
so,
muscle memory.
Right. So it was a crazy, crazy, crazy experience for my debut, and that's why I literally think that the Opry has done such a great job over this last decade of documenting for these artists, because I literally have one picture. I have one picture of the evening, and it wasn't even me on stage. It was me walking off stage and hugging my wife. And her dad was standing in the background, and that's the only true memory that I have of my debut.
Do you have a copy of that photo at
home? Oh, absolutely. Okay, I have that photo. But I don't have the video. I don't have anything, because at the time it wasn't something that, you know, we really thought about.
Greg,
that's what I think that the Opry has done a really good job of, is over the last, you know, 15, 20 years documenting those for these artists so that they have that memory.
Well, I was going to ask Greg, too, are there people that – does everybody understand the gravity of what it means to step into the circle?
I don't think they do. I think it's – you know, even for my office, and I have people who work for me, one of the things I did 6 or 8 months ago, I realized we're out there all the time. You go out there with Mark and others, and you go spend time at the Opry. I've lived a little more history than they have and been out there enough, so I knew some things. So I actually ended up calling the Opry and made everybody in the office go out and watch the movie they have out front and then do the tour as somebody who's not back there
before
all the time.
They go on stage.
Well, I had my staff do it.
That's
so
smart.
They understand when they come back, when they're taking somebody to the Opry for the first time who may not understand the depth of the history or the tradition behind it, that they've spent some time and they understand, hey, this is the history. This is why this matters so much.
What used to be the gift shop out front where you buy your T-shirts, they moved that and they created this room. And there's a 13-minute video that is sort of an encapsulation of the last 100 years of the Opry's history. And out of everything that I had ever seen or been witness to, I literally cry every time I watch it.
Really?
Yes. Hmm. It's that good.
See, I haven't done that.
Oh, it's one of those things that I don't want to spoil it for you, so I don't want to tell you too much. But it is one of those things where when you watch it, you get enough of the history to know just how much it means to the members, but the people that dream, the little boy in Georgia, you know, as a 6-year-old. Watching the Grand Ole Opry or hearing the Grand Ole Opry and telling his papa, one day I want to sing on there. And then, you know, and then here's the 51-year-old man that's been an Opry member for 6 years. Mm. It's amazing. It truly encapsulates the history of the Opry. And you can go in there and not know anything about it and leave that room or leave that building a fan.
You know, it's carried on WSM AM, AM 650 in Nashville, and that signal goes, out to, does it clear the, well, I mean, you were the program director there for a long time.
Schaefer, only 3 years.
How far does it go?
It's doesn't go as far as it used to just because we have so much different interference now.
Right.
But it used to be 38 states. It would go across 38 states. It would reach the whole way out to the Rockies. And there are times, especially in the summertime, when the signal gets into the atmosphere that you could hear it the whole way over in Europe.
Yeah, they
over
call
the
it
air.
Atmospheric skip or whatever
yes,
it is.
Yes, an atmospheric skip. But during that time in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, you could hear it throughout most of the country at night.
Back before our world was so cluttered with signals and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was getting back to when I was saying about how when they put the cast together – your Saturday night was your time. It was the way to get your new single to the world, you know?
All at once. Yeah.
You know, people would tune in Florida, in Nebraska, in New York, in Texas, and, you know, wherever, listening to the Grand Ole Opry, and they would hear, you know, they would hear Loretta sing her new song. They would hear Patsy sing her new song. They would hear Hank sing his new song. And that's what grew the Opry's brand so large And then, you know, and then they would have. Then they would have that Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday to travel. And there were many times, you know, when they talked about Mr. Tubb, and they would host the show. They would host the show on Saturday night, and literally as the curtain was coming down, they were loading up the bus and they were heading to Texas, or they were heading to wherever, and they would
play the shows.
Yeah, to spend that week traveling.
Craig, why the Opry? Why did the Opry become what it has become as compared to back during the time the Louisiana Hayride was like a competitor? The Opry? Where was the success from?
I think there was a turning point when the NBC network, the radio network, picked it up, and suddenly it became a national broadcast. Nobody else had that. And then as the industry, I mean, there's so much music industry here now, and a lot of that was because of the figures at the Opry. So also, you may agree with this, like without the Opry, we may not have the Nashville music business. It was really the centerpiece of the industry.
It all kind of fed each other, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah.
Well, you had Bristol, which is where some of the original recordings happened. You had Atlanta, which WSB in Atlanta was where some of the first country records were recorded, you know, back in the 20s, you know, but Nashville, I think the Opry kind of solidified this town as where everybody who wanted to make country music, where they came to. And that's where that, you know, that legend of the Opry grew, and you had all of the big stars of the day on that show. And so everybody wanted to, you know,
it became home base.
Right. It became home base.
So when a few years ago, Craig, the Opry really kind of changed its focus. It seems like it got bigger. Well, I don't know. Was there a regime change or something that happened maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I think really there was some couple of general managers over the years.
But I mean, there was a real, over the last, it seems like.
You're talking image-wise?
Yeah, it seems like there's been just a big push for the Opry. I don't know if it's kind of building up because this is the 100th year or whatever. But I mean, even before this, it seemed like there was a lot of more publicity about it.
Yeah, I think because over the pandemic, they still staged shows and people around the world were hearing the Opry, and it was the most viewed music program in the world.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures of no one in the, like, they did the lights or whatever they did.
It was crazy. You talk about paranormal activity.
Yes.
You could feel it. You could feel it in the room when you were on that stage during 2020. I played the 4th of July on stage.
And no one's in the audience?
No one was in the crowd.
That's Creepville.
So I don't remember how they did it. Did they pipe in like applause or
no.
they just,
no, no,
it
no,
was
no.
just
it was,
silence?
Son, it was dead. There wasn't a sound in the house. So what you would do, and that's what made it difficult. We're so used to being on stage and talking to, you know, and having that banner back and forth with you know, the audience members and somebody.
C-32A.
Right, exactly. Or, you know, or saying, hey, you know, how many of you are here for the very first time in Nashville? And, you know, and you have that, you know, you build that rapport with the audience. There was nothing. So, like, you know, so we're on stage and the light goes red. And here we go. And you play your first song, and then you're staring at a camera, and
you have more people at a sound check for a show nowadays than you did then.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was so the way that it worked, and I'm just going off my recollection of it, but there was one director in the house, and you had these automated cameras from, you know, from multiple spots in the room. And the band, you weren't allowed to, you know, during COVID, nobody could go to each other's dressing room. So they would call you over the speaker and they would say, you know, Mark, you're on in 5 minutes. And you would go to the right-hand side of the stage and you had to exit off the left-hand side of the stage.
Wow.
There was no interaction. And it was the quietest that building had ever had.
And your soul could feel spirits, you think?
You could feel something in there.
Was it, do you think, the ghosts of the artists of the past, or do you think of the crowds of the past?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that would be cool. Like, okay, so.
Whatever, I mean, people pick up different energies.
I used to work in a radio station that did live radio shows back in the 20s and 30s, back in the day. Mm-hmm. And just like we have these big glass windows here, I had a window in front of me, but my back was to the auditorium where the staircase was and all that. So I would turn the light off in the room right there so I could use that window as a mirror to see what was behind me.
Yeah.
And I would see people constantly. I worked at night back then. I would see people constantly walking by. And mm-hmm. When I say constantly, every 10, 15 minutes, somebody comes walking by. And they're all going into the auditorium.
There's just no way. And I couldn't do it.
I would walk out of the studio and I would go over there. It was a dead end. They had the doors padlocked.
Yeah.
So where did these people go? And I saw them all night, every night.
Bubba said he walked up the stairs. And, well, you can tell him, this is the craziest.
So I was walking up, and it was an old Art Deco building. I mean, it was beautiful, built back in the day. So they have these big marble staircases that lead up to the front, and there's a ticket booth right here, and then there's the windows that look into the studios. So as I'm walking, you're going up the stairs, and you start to see what's above the stairs. And I could see the window, and I look, and all of a sudden I freeze because there's a person in one of the studios, like the little green room in between the studios, with their back to me. And I was like, oh, God, it's a burglar or somebody. Who is that? And I'm just kind of staring. At that moment, the guy turns around. We lock eyes, and he disappeared. Oh, I kid you not. It was the freaky. I was like, I froze for a second, and I ran as fast as I could down those stairs, across the street to the bank where they had security guards. I'm like, dude, pull up your cameras. Who's been in there? And I tried telling them what's up. I called the program director that night. It was like 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. I'm like, dude, I'm never going back there again. Mm-hmm. I'm done. Yeah. See ya.
I can see it in your eyes.
It was. Oh, yeah. It was
his eyes water.
Craziest thing.
I can see it in your eyes.
It was the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. Dude, the guy just, we locked eyes and poof. Gone.
You had
and
that experience.
He was solid.
I mean, that's wild that you saw someone just completely disappear.
Yeah. It was weird. Yeah. It wasn't like, you know, in the movies where they fade or whatever. It was just, boop, gone.
It's like you blinked and they were gone?
And yeah. And he was wearing, looked like, and I can still see him, like a big coat, like a suit jacket and a fedora. I remember it like, I see the guy's face, but I don't remember anything about his face. I see his face, but I can't describe it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm going home now.
So, yeah, obviously, the Opry has a lot of that going on, too.
I think, Craig, you go into the flooding as well, I'm sure. I haven't seen that part in the book.
Yeah.
That was a devastating. I mean, you were there at the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how bad was it?
The water was 6 feet over the top of the stage. And there's actually a marker that's in the green room that shows you where the flood level was in the building. And to go back to this being the longest running radio show in the world, even after all that have happened, the Opry still ran on Saturday nights.
And where'd y'all do it from?
One was at the War Memorial. I think one of them was at the Catholic Church across the street.
Oh, really?
I think the very first one was
after the
flood.
What a great trivia question.
Oh, it was unbelievable. But yeah, they weren't back in there for several months. There's pictures there of people kayaking into the Opry.
It was Tyler, the stage manager.
Yep, kayaking into the Opry to do damage assessment.
What?
Yeah,
yeah.
That's where we lost. That's actually where we lost so many of those old TNN tapes because they had the tape warehouse in the Opry, like in the back, and so we lost a lot of the great old footage.
There's no way to recover any of that.
Some of it was just destroyed. They did recover some of it. That wasn't as bad, but there was some of it that was just beyond repair.
Craig, did you get to look at like old thing? Oh, you had to put on white gloves to watch. Look at this.
Not too much. Not too much. Most of my research was actually in the print area because the Opry was covered so thoroughly by Nashville newspapers back then because it was such an important piece of Nashville. So, for example, when the time came in the book, Jan Howard became a member of the Opry. You can't just search Jan Howard Opry and find anything because that happened in 1971. But I pull up her artist file, which the Opry's kept all these clippings from.
Is it like actual news clippings or is it like a microfiche where you have to flip through?
It's all pieces of paper, yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy. And then Jan had done an interview, I guess, and just kind of explained to the reporter how it happened, which like 50 years later, it's like, this is exactly what I needed. So the Opry's done a really great job of saving, of preserving the history of their members. And it was remarkable how I was able to kind of dig through that and find things that we haven't heard already. You know, there's so many Opry stories that have just kind of been told a million times, but there's a lot in this book that I don't know that's ever really been told in a book.
This is one of the funniest things for me still, is that some of the older timers there at the Opry still refer to the Grand Ole Opry mm-hmm. House as the new building.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And it's been there for 50 yeah. years.
Well, it's actually been in the Opry House longer than it mm-hmm. was in any other place.
That's correct, yeah. yeah.
We only spent 30 years at the Ryman, and we've been in the Opry House, the new house, for 51, I guess, going on 52.
Yeah. One of the best things I saw when I was researching was involved Mark, actually, and you're singing Don't Laugh at Me, and everyone comes on the stage with you.
Oh, yeah.
Remember this?
That was the night I was invited.
Like everybody from the wings, the members and some of the employees, and they just stood with you.
Yeah.
It just felt so powerful because in the 90s chapter, there's some confrontation between the new members and the younger members, and there's a lot of colliding.
Like what happened?
Just the older members felt like they were being shifted off to the side in favor of the new artist.
Mm-hmm.
But when that moment...
So for the class of 89 coming in, is that when the drama started?
Mostly, I think it was kind of more like the early 90s. Yeah, the early 90s, I would say, was when there was a little bit more drama. Because
did it ever get to fisticuffs?
Fisticuffs.
No. I'm saying it.
Someone
man.
Got a pie in the
fisticuffs.
Face.
Fisticuffs.
Somebody got a pie in the
pie
face.
I just
made that up. I just made that up.
Like are we in a cartoon?
Tom and Jerry.
Well, part of the reason.
Wise guy.
Yeah. So the older members, I've always been told, like, if you play the Opry when you're young, the Opry will take care of you when you're older. And so there was a guy. I don't know how to phrase it, but like, if you played the Opry enough times in the year, you would get insurance coverage from the Opry.
Oh wow!
But
all
if right. you didn't play enough. Shows yeah. you wouldn't get that coverage. So they wanted to play it, but then they would say, oh, we've got this new guy on Warner Brothers, and we're going to give him the slot. Sorry.
Oh.
And it kind of was a situation where these older members didn't trust it anymore. I don't right. want to speak on their behalf, but there was some right. resentment there because they were willing to be there and had dedicated their career to it, and suddenly...
And it was also a little mm. paycheck, too. Mm. I mean, it was something that you play a couple times, you get a little bit of money, and you're you know, it's your golf money or whatever it may be.
Yeah. Also, if you get health insurance.
And the health
that's
insurance.
That's a really big thing. For an artist. Yeah. For an artist, that's massive.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I realized until this book, like, how pivotal the 90s were to the Opry, because that was the year, that was the decade we lost Minnie Pearl and Bill Monroe and Grandpa Jones and Roy Acuff, and it's like, what now? Like, these were the people that you could see at the Opry since the 20s and 30s.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Minnie Pearl joined in, yeah, probably say 30s and 40s, because Minnie Pearl joined in 1940, kind of like a low peak, like a low moment of her career. She was doing a comedy routine at a insurance sale, like at a banking convention, I think it was. And someone who saw her performance called the Opry and said, you might like her. You should give her a shot. So she went up to the insurance company and auditioned. They're like, okay, we'll put you on really late. Because by then, people who are listening will just, you know, they probably already turned off the radio.
Craig, can you speak to the importance of Little Jimmy Dickens to the Opry? Because I was there when Little Jimmy passed
yeah.
away.
And, yeah.
and just the impact of that man to the institution.
Yeah, Jimmy loved those legendary figures as much as we all did. Like, he kind of came on the scene around the time of Hank Williams, but he idolized Roy Acuff. Mm-hmm. And so Jimmy brought a sense of fun, I guess, in his later years. There was a time when he left the Opry and was gone for a good chunk of time. He came back in 1975 and stayed. But people loved the jokes. I mean, I always did. We all yeah. heard the jokes, but, you know.
Didn't matter how many times you
didn't matter how many times. I'm Jimmy Dickens or Mighty Mouse in pajamas. Like, we, you know, I'm yeah. Willie Nelson after taxes. We've heard all the jokes.
Yep.
And I loved it, you know. And it's great because my parents would come visit me and we'd all go to the Opry, and that was the guy they wanted to see.
Yeah. Well, he was so good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his heart. I remember, you know, as we sit here and talk about that and you talk about the jokes, that's not what I remember. I remember the man.
Yeah.
I remember my girls, particularly Macy. But Macy and Mally are now 26 and 22. But when they would come to the Opry, he would be walking down the hallway, you know, and have a 4-year-old in your dressing room. And, you know, it was just like, you know, and he would stop by and I can hear it. I can hear, hello, ladies. You know, and he would come in and he would say hey to the girls. And they would, you know, and we'd be in dressing room number 5 and he was dressing room number 3. And Macy would go, I'm going to go see my friend. And I knew exactly who she was.
Aw.
And he was always the first one to arrive.
Yeah.
Yeah. He got there early.
Always carrying his coat back. Yep. You know, I remember it.
His shoulder?
Oh, absolutely. Never wore his stage clothes in. Always brought them in a bag. He would bring it, had it over his shoulder. He'd have his cowboy hat. It was so funny. I can remember having his cowboy hat on and his boots on. And like, you know, never mind. I can't tell that story. but I mean, he would come in with his cowboy hat on and, you know, and like a little jacket and some pants and his boots, and he would carry it over his shoulder.
How cool, Craig, to do this book and get all this information and the research, and then also be able to sit next to Mark here and hear a member's take on it all
firsthand.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And also, what the heck? This is your first book? Are you
this
crazy?
This is your first book?
It is my first book. Yeah, what? I've been a journalist for a long time, but this is the first book.
Well,
wow.
You very well done.
Knocked it out of the park.
Thank you.
It's called 100 Years of Grand Ole Opry. Craig Shelburne and Mark, thank you, dude. Absolutely. And also, why is it every time you come in here, you make me tear up? And it's annoying. I'm not a fan of
it. What happened last time?
Last time, yeah. It was, I was just singing at this class with these kids, and we're singing Don't Laugh at Me. And here's a clip of it. And I'm like,
Well, if it makes you feel better. I teared up twice today.
Well, and the Bubba teared up once, too, telling his ghost story.
No ghost stories for me. That's why you will never, ever, ever, ever see me taking a ghost tour.
No.
Because I don't want to see it. We stayed at a place one time, the Silverton Hotel, I think.
You
in
and
Durango.
I?
Yeah, I remember. And they're like, this is a haunted hotel, man.
You're at the Hampton Inn then.
I was elsewhere.
Yeah, we were in California doing a visit or whatever, and we're the radio station. They're like, yeah, well, you know, our tower site is haunted. Our old engineer died there, and to this day, like, you'll hear knocks on the door, and you look out the window, and there's no one knocking on the door. I'm like, dude, let's go. Bubba's like, I'll see you guys tomorrow morning.
You ain't going. I'm out. I'm good.
I'll meet y'all at the buffet.
Not going to happen.
See y'all then. Guys, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
And again, the book, 100 Years of Grand Ole Opry, is available everywhere and anywhere you can get your books. We highly suggest you get it from the Opry gift shop. Because that means you get to go to the Opry.
There you go.
That's right,
man. Make a trip. Make a plan. If you've never been and you love country music, it is. I mean, I tell people all the time because they reach out. They're like, hey, we're going to Nashville. What should we do? I'm like, well, have you checked out Opry.com yet? Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, why? I'm like, oh, my gosh. Do that first. Lock in your tickets for whatever show you want to go to because you're going to thank me later. And every single person is like, oh, we're so glad we went to the Opry. We saw this star and this star and this star and this star.
And they had a connection. They had a personal connection and had a great time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And last night they had to listen to him sing.
Had to.
All right.
Unless we're you good? Left early.
Y'all ready for the closing jingle?
I can't believe you're the one who did Jacob's Ladder. I never realized that. That you did that? That was your song?
Really?
No.
I'm going to hit the button now.
I know about your 19 whatever song. This was a podcast, but now it's over.
But that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show on the radio.
Wait, what happened? Wait, what?
No.
You're having a conversation?
No, I'm not. I was just asking him if he'd seen this picture.
Oh, okay. Well, then we're going to go back to this.
This was a podcast, but now it's over. But that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show on the radio every day.
It was the Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
The Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast. The Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
The Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.